Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on DLive.TV/Dave Martel. We have a full panel tonight who we will introduce here in a second, but I want to make sure I give everybody a chance to go over to Facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish, our boy Neil John over at Iron Age Jodish, to give you an actual reading from ancient Vedic astrology. Man, this stuff is absolutely incredible. Go check it out. Facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish and tell them Big Dave sent you, and go get go see what the stars have to say for you. And then also, we're doing big boy stuff now. We're in the big boy game. So make sure to go over to Patreon.com/TheBog and go sign up. Yeah, we have several different tiers. You can get on an RSS feed, so you can get audio of all of our shows, which I'm going to upload very, very soon. And if you like The Bog, you like what we do here, make sure you support us. So go over to patreon.com/TheBog. There's a tier for everybody, so go check that out. Give us a look and stuff like that. But one second here. Let me get everybody unmuted here. Tonight, we have a full panel. It's going to be pretty cool. We're talking about wolf cults. We have, like always, my co-host Tristan. Along for the ride, we have Miss Heidi, and then also the Wolfman himself, Mr. Ian. How's everybody doing tonight?
Pretty good.
Doing good. How are you, Dave?
Doing good.
I'm doing pretty good, Dave.
Wonderful. Excellent. So let's get started here. Ian, you are the Wolfman. Like, you are really into wolves, period. Not just into, like, wolves and mythology and lore and so on and so forth, but you're also involved with wolves in real life as well.
Yeah. I've got going back to my early childhood, I've got a lot of experience with canids, but, you know, wolves in particular have always been a favorite of mine. I've always loved them. I mean, a lot of people have a favorite animal, but for me, it was never really a choice. It was just kind of like from the get-go, from my earliest memories, that was what I went with. And call me the Wolf Man, and I'm not Lon Chaney. And I'm not a furry, but most people know me as, like, because of the nature of the dogs that I have and because of my interests, what I do, what my knowledge base is. A lot of people know me as the Wolf Man or the Dog Guy, and I'm pretty okay with that.
Because so I hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, no, you're entirely right.
Very cool. So, Mr. Ian, give us a rundown. Like, wolves are a huge part of our imagery, our iconography. They are always part of our aesthetic. You know, whether you were reading the Eddas or we're looking at ancient artifacts, you know, the wolves are a reoccurring thing. So, what is the meaning of the wolf, and what is a wolf cult?
Oh, that's a good question. So in a pan, you know, Proto-Indo-European or just encompassing most of Europe kind of sense, the wolf is the prime example of the hunter. And in a lot of cases, this translates to human society as the warrior. So going back to, you know, the Bronze Age, and I would argue the Stone Age, the wolf cult, the war band that emulates the wolf, that is something that's kind of as intrinsic to human social behavior as pretty much anything else, I would argue. And for that reason also, you know, despite our anatomical similarities to primates and, you know, whatnot, I would contest that canids are probably the species on Earth that is most like humanity, in the sense that we've evolved pretty much together, in the sense that it's molded. You know, we molded the evolution of the dog through our cohabitation with the wolf. And especially for the people of the steppe, you know, the people that eventually spread westward to become the Indo-Europeans and whatnot, to them, the wolf was, I would argue, the most important totem or ritualistic entity, aside from the horse, maybe, because it would just encompass the nature of the hunter, the warrior, and in a lot of cases, you know, the leader of the pack. Tribal society is heavily dependent on its leadership to succeed, whether it lives or dies. And so, you know, the wolf is an appropriate metaphor for a good leader, I would think.
Very cool. So, Mr. Tristan, as far as with the lore and maybe with the spiritual symbols or anything of that nature, when we see a wolf in maybe we see it in a painting or maybe carved into a stone, or whenever we see a depiction of a wolf, what is usually associated with that?
Well, in the Germanic culture, we have to understand that a wolf is primarily considered almost a negative symbol. It's associated with outlaws, with the scavengers living on the borderlands of society. But especially when we're talking about a religious brotherhood angle, like the Ulfhefnar, we have to understand that this is associated with the god Odin primarily, and it has connotations of like a feral savagery, something that isn't quite civilized, wasn't accepted amongst normal society. And also it has a very strong pack-oriented kind of culture to it. The Ulfhefnar were a religious brotherhood of young men who went into the woods and lived as bandits, and they bonded with each other and stayed together like a pack of wolves.
Tristan, my friend, if I may contest what you just said in spirit, though not in essence for a moment, you're right on all counts, definitely. But I think the negativity associated with the wolf in Germanic culture, I think that is honestly a relic of viewing our histories and whatnot through a Christian lens, and in the sense that the wolf is entirely, almost universally negative in their lens. And I think the main example of this would be Odin himself, in the sense that, you know, you have a lot of wolves in Norse mythology, or, you know, Germanic mythology and whatnot. The most famous ones, of course, are the bad ones, you know, Fenrir and Skull and Hati and all that. But I think there's a very subtle difference that's, you know, it's subtle, but it's also stark in the right context, between a wolf and, you know, what we'd call a warg, or, you know, in the Tolkien-esque kind of sense. In the sense that a warg is specifically a wolf that is almost kind of, has fell intent, you know, it's kind of it's an evil wolf. Usually it's kind of, you know, described as being larger, you know, usually monstrously so, sometimes with attributes that we might consider demonic or evil or, you know, ghoulish or something like that. But in my interpretation, I feel that the warg is to the wolf just what, you know, the giant is to, you know, the Aesir or the Vanir, or, you know, really the dualistic nature of man himself. And I think that the wolf in Germanic folklore is morally gray, just like man himself is. And I think that's why, you know, the cult of the wolf, the wolf brotherhood that's so prevalent among European society, I think that's part of the reason why it exists in the way that it does. And I also think it's an extremely healthy thing for society. Now, not that I'm endorsing gang culture in any way or anything like that, but you'll notice that young men, pretty much regardless of ethnicity or religion or whatever, they tend to congregate in groups that operate very much like wolf packs would. They like to occupy territory, you know, they like to stake out their favorite bar, or their favorite hangout, or, you know, whatever it is. And in more extreme cases and more violent cases, this does turn into like gang kind of stuff. But for most people, it's, you know, their social circle, their group of friends that they go and they, you know, watch a game and have a beer with.
Your bro squad.
That kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Your pack. And I think in especially in the old days, you know, especially places where this was notorious, places like, you know, Germanic areas or Ireland, primeval Ireland, this whole, you know, when you live in a society where raiding and pillaging is not just, you know, a thing that you dread happens, it's an active part of society and part of daily life, both for you and your rivals, it makes sense that young men would be benefited by having this kind of, this warrior band, this wolf pack that they join with other young men who are like them, and they have, you know, mutual defense, mutual camaraderie, mutual gain to be had in the case of them being on the offensive, or, you know, in the sense of staying alive on the defensive. And so I think that's a healthy expression of young masculinity manifested in a socially useful way, especially for the culture in question at the given time.
In regards to in regards to being culturally useful or something, would you rather also want to differentiate between the hound and the wolf rather than just between the wolf and the warg, basically?
Slightly. Me and Tristan talked about this a bit, but I think dogs and wolves in terms of totemic energy kind of thing, they're very similar, but there are some stark differences in the sense that the hound is more the civilized aspect.
That's what I mean, right? I mean, the wolf kind of is outside of the perimeter for the most part, and the hound is inside of the perimeter.
But then you have examples like where Geri and Freki are referred to as Odin's hounds, or where, you know, Garm is referred to as, you know, Hel's hound.
Yeah, so exactly, which makes it actually kind of hard to interpret whether or not they are
I don't necessarily think it does. I think it's just, I think it's a title more than anything. I think that the term of, you know, hound applied to this creature, this warg usually, denotes ownership or denotes allegiance. So Odin's wargs.
I would agree with that.
And I think
it's more about poetic appellation than anything.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, despite the idea that, you know, our ancestors were a bunch of fur clad axe dragging barbarians, they were a very poetic people. You know,
I wouldn't even say that. It's like such an annoying trope.
I disagree with that. I feel that you know, after doing all the research and looking into it, our ancestors weren't barbarians. They were actually very advanced people. They mapped the stars. They had advanced naval systems. They had trade routes. They had systems of philosophy and theology that they understood, and it didn't all get written down, at least that we have preserved. But these weren't dummy, goofy, you know, people. These were intelligent, sophisticated, advanced people for the amount of resources and technology that they had.
Absolutely. I mean, the Romans admired them for a reason. Tacitus, you know, he basically, a lot of people are convinced that what he was writing was basically propaganda, but he really admired the Germanic peoples to the point of saying that, you know, if they were equipped, you know, in the manner that we are with, you know, tools and civilizational things like that, there's no way we'd stand against them, because these are an austere, militant, strong people, and we've grown decadent and weak.
So I do want to address, we have a donation from Folkish Farmer over here.
All right.
Who is asking, how close are German shepherds to wolves? And I was looking into this. Yeah, it is actually fairly close. Scientists believe that the German shepherd was at least one quarter wolf. Mm-hmm. So they're actually very, very closely related.
Do you want me to go into my dogs real quick? That was kind of a perfect segue.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Yeah. So my family is big on dogs. When I was a kid, my dad had a wolf dog that was a wolf and a German shepherd mix that he got while he was working in Wyoming. Basically because a wolf got into his backyard when he had a female German shepherd, and he kept one of the puppies.
My man, what a
dad. Yeah, pretty much. He was kind of like a beastmaster. Like, he would literally go and tame animals. Like, he'd go and get desert tortoises and desert iguanas. Just be like, oh yeah, I found it, you know. Whatever. But, you know, my mom always had German shepherds when she was young, and that was kind of their mutual favorite breed. So they've always been kind of close to home for me. And when I was a teenager, I really wanted a dog of my own, and my mom made me do copious amounts of scholarly research. I had to be an expert on dogs before she would allow me to get one, because she didn't want to be responsible for it at all. You know, fair enough.
Understand.
And so in my research, I found that the original, you know, Prussian guy that made the German Shepherd line as we know it, he used what I would kind of loosely term a Rhineland Shepherd dog. It's kind of the shared ancestor of, you know, the Belgian Malinois, the Belgian Shepherd, the German Shepherd, the Alsatian, like all these kind of West German, Eastern Low Countries breeds that kind of look similar. That plus a wolf was the stock template that he wanted to use for this dog breed, to combine, you know, like potency and obedience and intelligence. And even today, wolf, for when you go to, I would actually kind of heavily discourage it, but if you were ever to go and try to buy a wolf dog, you'll note that a lot of the template base is German Shepherd, because it's a fairly stable breed that can kind of provide a reliable temperament or expectation no matter what's mixed with it. So I have my first dog kind of when I became an adult and was on my own. It was a Mastiff Mutt mix, but, you know, eventually for his companion, I ended up getting a wolf dog because my girlfriend found her on the internet, and, you know, she basically, you know, took advantage of the fact that she knew I wouldn't be able to resist it, because she was mixed with Husky and German Shepherd, and she always wanted one of those. And so adopted her, and, you know, she's been wonderful. And it's really given me a lot of appreciation for how wolf dogs are different than other dogs, and how they're not a trendy pet that people should get because they're cool and exotic. But if you're a serious dog owner that has experience with big dogs, then you're probably okay. But the thing that was really significant about Luna, when she was young, we had an incident where she kind of got aggressive with my other dog, because even though she was much smaller than him, wolf dogs are notorious for kind of being a little fiery. And I made the mistake of, you know, gently touching her from behind, but in a way that spooked her while she was in the middle of snarling at him. And so she doubled back and bit me on the thumb and actually totally shattered it, you know, just mutilated my thumb. I had to go to the hospital and, you know, it was really messed up. And to this day, it's got a really big gash of a scar in the middle of it. But through that experience and a lot of other stuff, I've just kind of come to accept, you know, that the savagery of the wolf is part of its intrinsic nature, and that it's not something that I should fear or should hold in contempt or negativity, but it's just something that I should embrace as part of its nature, as, you know, a child of Earth. And for me, I really, you know, from childhood, as I said, I was into wolves. I always had wolf iconography all over. But when I was around 17, you know, the emergence of adulthood, I really kind of got hard into, you know, Germanic religion and folklore. And I was just compelled to Odin, despite, you know, the kind of popularity of Thor and some other deities because of pop culture. There was just something about this kind of mysterious old man figure that had this potent kind of primal savagery hidden under his cloak that kind of drew me in. And so I really dug deep and researched the Ulfethnar, the brotherhood that Tristan mentioned. And I almost don't know how to describe it, but ever since then, I've never been able to shake this, this adherence to a religious creed that frankly, it's entirely my own. Unlike you guys, whose knowledge and research I respect immensely, I'm not a theologian. I'm not really a scholar in the subject so much as I just kind of have a rudimentary or maybe spurgy set of knowledge or interest points. And the rest of it is really just passion and zeal that's maintained by meditation and contemplation. Odin in particular is just such an enigmatic figure that's so many things. And so for me personally, I worship Odin as, you know, as the wolf god, or, you know, Ygglftir, I would say, the terrible one, you know, the wolf god, because I recognize that Odin, much like all things in life, is very dualistic in his nature, and that an attribute that I would associate with savagery or with violence doesn't make it bad or evil. It's just a fact of life, and it's something you should accept and embrace and understand rather than fear or revile.
And, you know, Ian, that's kind of what I was getting at when I was saying that the Norse kind of had a negative portrayal of wolves. But, you know, like, I should be clear that I don't mean that wolves were evil in a sense, that, you know, they had a proper place in society on the outskirts of it amongst young men and warriors. And, you know, even Odin, he has his two, you know, his two wolves, Gerly and Freki, and that imparts a savage ken to it, him that our ancestors would have immediately picked up on. One of the trends you'll see in the sagas is when someone sees another person's hamingja, it'll come in the form of an animal, and the animal can be ascribed certain characteristics to their soul, basically. You know, like some people who are noble and everything like that, they'll have like bears or something, but savage people who are fierce and very, very violent, often have a wolf as their hamingja, and that's, you know.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's just something that our ancestors inherently associated with this.
Now, speaking of that, I actually wanted to kind of go back. Miss Heidi said something interesting that I kind of wanted to hear a little more about. She believes that there is a difference between, at least as far as iconography goes, between the hound and the wolf. And she said something about inside, outside the perimeter. And I'd like her to expound on that a little bit, because I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the perimeter obviously is kind of what marks the society versus wilderness or nature, right? Like the organized portion of life versus the disorganized portion, basically. And so the hound exists within that, and the wolf exists without that. And I mean, if you look at warrior bands or young men and all that, you may obviously look at that for like the wolf pack thing as a positive or as a binding energy between them and everything. But this is a very small partition of society. These young warriors, right? I mean, they eventually also grow up to not be just young warriors, but become fathers, grandfathers, whatever. And within that circle and within that perimeter, they can't be wolves. because wolves are destructive in that sense, right?
Are you sure?
Yes, obviously. I mean, well, have you ever had, have you ever spoken to a sheep farmer or something who had like a run-in with a wolf?
Oh, I mean, wolf conservation ranchers.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously like a real life situation that people were facing, especially in the winter months, with like wolves aren't necessarily your friend. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not like they're evil or anything. It's not like demonic. But they are obviously a huge threat to your survival if you don't have the hounds, if you don't have Thumas at the perimeter of your society to defend against those strong forces that come in from the outside. And I think that's where the wolf is definitely a very ambivalent animal. It's definitely not just gloriously strong and beautiful or, you know, but it is dangerous and threatening as well. And that's where it's ambivalent. Right?
I don't really believe that it is all that dangerous.
I mean, to humans. Our ancestors, at the time that they live, like now, what would you say the population of wolves is now? 30, 40,000 in the world, maybe? That might even be high.
Outside of the Russian taiga, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, I read some numbers one time. They said there was probably 18,000 wolves left in the entire world. But whether those numbers are true, it doesn't matter. That's like you said, perilously low. But in the time of our ancestors, when this lore was being written down, and our ancestors still had their order of priests that were teaching these ideas and teaching about the spirit of the wolf, this was a time that if you got lost in the woods, wolves could eat you. You know what I mean? They weren't pets. You know what I mean? They were a force of nature that would eat you. So it's not, you know, it's not a far.
Well, not only that, but in the sagas and the historical references we see, it's not often wolves are presented as dangerous to travelers or something of that sort. What they often are depicted as is scavengers of the battlefield almost.
Right. Exactly.
So
they're not really maliciously like we don't really have documented cases of wolf attacks that aren't attributed to like severe famine or mange or something like that. And frankly, from a biological and an ecological level, I don't see any reason why wolves would somehow become more docile towards humans over time. I think that they probably represented the same amount of threat to our ancestors that they do today, i.e., it's something that'll ruin your life if you're a farmer.
Yeah, it's a very real economic threat, though, honestly.
Right, like if you're a farmer and it's killing your chickens or your cattle, yes, it's a very real economic threat. But if is it a threat to your life personally? Not so much.
I don't know.
Well, that is
a
threat to my life personally. If you can't eat, it's kind of a problem, you know, in the wintertime.
You could always turn to cannibalism.
I believe we have switched all the way to Homo homini lupus. Wolfman is the wolf of man.
Well, and that alone is already also like these kinds of sayings and these phrases also tell you a lot about the perception of wolves, you know, because that particular phrase that you just said is obviously kind of telling.
And one more thing I wanted to touch on is there's kind of fear is kind of a loaded term, because when somebody says fear, you think of something that is scary and must be destroyed. And that's kind of the connotation that modern people have. If it's scary and it's dangerous, it must be destroyed. You know, our ancestors very much feared the gods. You know, I mean, they feared the gods' wrath. Our ancestors feared nature, but they respected it. Something that is scary and something that you fear doesn't necessarily mean, and just because even if it could be your enemy, doesn't mean that you should go and destroy it, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's evil either. When we talk about things
often it gets appeased, right? You appease it instead of destroying it.
Exactly. You appease it. That's why we give, that's not the whole reason we give bloat to the gods, but we do give bloat to the gods because they are so immensely powerful. You know what I mean? Like, why would you not want to appease these deities that could just destroy you? Why would you not want to make it so these wolves aren't going to eat you? And I'm sorry, Ian, I'm saying back a couple thousand years ago, there were way more wolves, and to think that they would not just, like, you know, they're predators. Bears eat people today. You know, mountain lions eat people today. They're carnivorous animals.
Like, well, I mean, big cats are a very different animal from wolves.
A wolf, here's a big walking piece of ham that runs slower than me, has no actual, you know, way to fight me, and I humans are easy food. Why wouldn't they eat us?
Well, there's a bit of a difference between, say, bears and like tigers or lions or something, or animals that could, I guess we could, you know, square up and like kick your ass, right? That's not really how wolves fight. They mostly, you know, come down to pack with packs and pick on like
the weak and the sick and the old.
Yeah, the weak and the sick kind of animals
and the
tear
children
them down and, you know, right. I mean, they'll attack children for sure. They'll attack you if they think you're weak or alone or sick. But just in the way human society organizes itself since, you know, the Stone Age, mostly we, you know, we're not real tempting targets to wolves.
But the point that I'm getting at is just because you're
not really in their prey range.
But what I'm getting at here is there was a time that people were probably, they did fear wolves. And I don't think that that's when we look at the idea of fear, we shouldn't have this completely dualistic thing to it. You know what I mean? Because we fear good things too. You know what I mean? We always,
you can like things you're afraid of. I'm terrified of the ocean, but I love the ocean.
The ocean is absolutely beautiful. I'm scared to go more than 20 feet when I go to the beach. Like
anytime I see that deep blue void that you see on Blue Planet a lot, where they just like pan the camera down in the middle of the open ocean.
Yeah,
that scares the hell out of me.
When you're actually in the deep blue void, that is terrifying.
Yeah,
I don't dig that. Hell no.
I'm afraid to see monsters for sure.
Oh, I don't care about the monsters. I'm afraid of like drowning.
I'm scared of sharks. Oh, big time scared of sharks.
Oh man.
All right. So
yeah, but I mean the other thing that I wanted to add that I was just kind of thinking is in North America it looks a little bit different because there are also mountain lions and stuff like that, you know, which are more like deadlier animals than canines. But we in Europe, like there isn't such a cat there at that time. Like the lynx isn't comparable to like a mountain lion or something like that, you know. So the wolf at that time is definitely the largest, most dangerous predator because bears aren't as active.
Well, you know, that's not entirely correct. During the early Roman period is when they finally made extinct the European lion. So
yeah,
prior
but, I
to
mean,
that,
where, how
you know,
far up did the lion go? I don't.
I think it's all the way up to the Rhineland, at least.
To the
Alps, definitely not like definitely not in like central northern Germany.
A bear is still far more dangerous than a wolf. I mean, wolves
are
actually
usually pretty timid. Yeah, but the bear doesn't go around hunting in packs.
No, but it's attracted to food, and if you're in the vicinity, it'll gore you and eat you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, I've been, like, I've had a lot of bears.
I mean, there are far more bear attacks documented than wolf attacks. Like, and the ratio is not even close. But something I would contest, though, that you said, that the position, you know, the wolf mentality is only for the young men. But I think that the experience wrought while a young man translates well into maturity. Like, you know, they become fathers and guardians and whatnot, like you said. So does the alpha wolf. And I think most men should aspire to be the alpha wolf, you know, in their particular tribe, as much as they can be.
You know, there is some rather significant evidence that, especially when talking about the Ulfhethnar and the berserkers in general, that there probably wasn't a very strong generational cutoff line where you just stopped being an Ulfhethnar, and in fact it might have been impossible for people to actually just stop, you know, like the example of Aegil Saga, where he's playing a ball game with some local kids and he goes into a berserker rage and almost kills one of them. That kind of shows that you know, this wasn't something a lot of these people had.
I believe he did kill them, didn't it say he broke every bone in his body?
And again,
yeah, he almost killed him, and he definitely maimed him.
This is actually not, like, this shows the wild card characteristic of this. I mean, it shows that if you have this wolf in your innangad, it can be a problem. You know, it is a wild card. That's all I'm saying. You know?
A lot of human traits are wild cards and problematic, though. I mean, the desire for wealth, the desire for sustenance easily becomes greed, and people do terrible things in the name of greed.
Yeah, but that's a little bit different than raw aggression, like the, you know, a testosterone-fueled raw aggression that you get. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, building up to greed and letting it contaminate your mind and being poisoned by these things. That's different than you're at the bar. I don't like the way this guy looks. I want to punch his teeth out. He doesn't like me. We get into a big fight. That's the wolf right there. You know what I mean?
That's kind of a simplistic reduction of the whole battle trance thing, though. I mean, this is a very ritualistic process that is. I mean, Tristan called them, you know, berserkers, and I don't mean to nitpick, but technically that only really is the bear ones. But, yeah, you know, the Ulfhethnar, the wolf cult, I mean, this is a very specific purpose, and you know, these guys are often recorded as being, you know, in the retinues of important people, you know, being kind of deployed as shock troops and whatnot. And it's because, you know, there's a lot of theories on how they used to psych themselves up, whether it was copious amounts of alcohol consumption, hallucinogenic mushrooms, epilepsy, mental illness, psychologically just working themselves up, like getting really hyped like football players do. But there's also the suggestion that it's genetic. And I actually feel like it's probably a combination of all of the above. But I think the genetic component plays a very large factor because, as we probably all know, a lot of times temperament is very much inheritable. And, you know, from personal experience, like, I have an ancestor that was an artillery officer that was ended up being put on leave because he was notorious for liking to shell stuff a bit too much, and kind of, you know, causing collateral damage. And ever since I was a kid, I've always had this weird thing where it's almost kind of an autistic tick where whenever I see artillery batteries just kind of do their thing, I just start to get really like excited and like, you know, like into it, like people watching like the final seconds of a sporting match or something. And that kind of thing, coupled with seeing how my grandparents are and like how, you know, other family members are, temperament is inheritable. And I think if you are in a position where you're like a member of a ritualistic cult where your primary function, you know, in society is to kind of become a foaming at the mouth monstrosity that's just going to wreck stuff on the battlefield, I think that's probably going to be pretty inheritable, the same way that a lot of times military service is a family thing and that veterans' kids go on to serve themselves.
Now,
yeah, I would agree with the idea that the berserker rage, or, you know, in this case, was primarily genetic. That it was primarily genetic. I mean, otherwise the entire situation I mentioned with Acho and his saga wouldn't have happened. He obviously wasn't copiously drinking or doing psychedelic mushrooms while playing a ball game with local children.
But I think there can be like psychological triggers to it, almost in the way that PTSD.
They mentioned that in the saga that it's just something that happens when those people get too excited or when they're doing physical labor and they work themselves up, and, you know, just something that can snap.
Have you ever been to like a metal show and like when the mosh pit starts going and everything's all like real high energy and like you can find you feel that spark in your blood, your hair stands on end, you just want to go crash into people, and you have that euphoric kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that kind of stimulus is exactly what they're talking about that sets off the battle trance.
You know, that's something that I've always told people, because, you know, I've been a metalhead my whole life, and I have friends that aren't metalheads, and they're like, what, you just guys go and like punch each other in the face? I'm like, dude, now, you go to a metal show, real metal show. I'm telling you, if you are a man, you're going to love it. You don't even have to like the music. But the fact that you're just around a bunch of other sweaty, wild dudes, and you guys are shoving each other, getting all wild, you're all drunk, you're all nuts, and it's fun. You're going to love it. I don't care if you like the music or not. When you're there and you're in the mosh pit, you're going to have an awesome time, because it's just a pure, raw expression of wild masculinity, even if it is contained and safe and stuff, because it's not brutal and
people
savage.
People are pretty nice, too. Yeah. Like I've seen, like, when people go down or when people start, like, deep-shotting people, like, people pick you up. And there's always a real sore reaction to the kind of people that start throwing elbows and fists and stuff like that.
No, it's a brotherhood. You know what I mean? It's like you're there. You guys are friends. This is a fraternity. And I've never in my life, a couple times, I went to a show that was overcrowded and some poor guys got trampled and stuff like that. But every other time, and this was at like a mainstream show, this wasn't an underground like death metal show or anything. Anytime I see anybody ever fall, you pick him up. Everybody around him stops, you pick him up. If he looks like he's getting woozy, you pass him off, get him some water, tell somebody. Mm-hmm. That kind of violent, crazy stuff, it just doesn't go down at metal shows. But I want to go into
You see more of that at hip hop concerts than metal shows.
Yeah, well,
anyway, off topic.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to bring up another thing about somebody mentioned about how this idea of the wolf pack, the man pack, the bro squad it should translate into adulthood. And our ancestors very much still had it into adulthood. It wasn't only until recently that we started to see the bro squad or the wolf pack, the man pack, the fraternity, going into adulthood as something that is childish or something that is a waste of your time or something you need to grow exactly. out of. And that's, I think this is a result of industrialization and, you know, modernity and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's the atomization of society, the reduction down to the nuclear family.
I think fraternity.
Yeah, for sure,
really,
but you do have to
forward.
Channel those energies differently when you're in the Inan Guard.
Well,
right?
Sure, like, but that comes with just maturity, though. I mean,
yeah, for sure, and I mean, still, men, not everyone can be the alpha wolf. Like, if in that,
no,
in
but,
that,
but
what we're just saying,
but you don't really have to be. Like, if I can make an example for you, real quick, like if you think of every man, you know, when he's a young man, he goes through that wolf, that warband period, and as he grows up, he becomes his own alpha wolf. In the human society, you know, that obviously doesn't translate perfectly. But if you see it in the, you know, in the sense of our ancestors, like their village set up, you know, the chieftains getting everyone ready to go do some group project. If you kind of look at it like all of these men are the alpha wolves of their individual homesteads, of their families. But when their leader, you know, their superior kind of calls them together, they fall back into that role, that experience they have as mm-hmm. as the wolf pack, as the war band. And so not everyone matures the same way, unfortunately, as we see in society. But the ideal is that the young men, these young wild wolves, become these chiseled tooth gray hunters, if you will. And wow. I mean, Odin himself, the Allfather, and he's the wolf god after all.
And well, I mean, we also have to consider when we're talking about the Innengard and the Utengard here that we shouldn't rely too heavily on our foundational basis in modern society when we're discussing this sort of thing. We have to remember that even a century ago, when people went into normal society, you know, today we have a very feminized culture that almost focuses upon women as the foundational aspect of society in the public sphere. But even a century ago, you know, like in 1930, the average public sphere was actually much, much more masculine. And it wasn't a consideration of women having to be, you know, there was almost a sense that women had to be protected or they should stay in the home because the public sphere was very specifically the masculine arena.
Yeah, what is the trope is women are masters of the inside, men are masters of the outside.
Yeah.
That's kind of like yeah. how the women are the keepers of the home, they control the home, and men are masters of the outside. And the outside also includes society at large. But
what I'm getting at there. Oh, I'm sorry, Dave. You can go on.
Oh no, I just wanted to bring up about you know, having a wolf pack. I mean, I've been running a kindred now for about 8 years, and let me tell you, when I obviously as a young man, I went through the young man phase and this and that, and then as I started to get a little bit older, and I met my wife, and we started to get atomized, as many groups do. You start to lose some of your humanity when you go through that atomization, and you just become a nuclear unit. You become just like a worker drone, and you kind of lose your vitality, and you lose some of your color, if you will. You lose a piece of yourself. But now that I'm an adult, and I you know, I have my kindred, and we have a bro squad. You know, I mean, my kinsmen, we come over, we play D&D, we have D&D nights, we go out and we go out into the woods and we do stuff. And you know, I mean, we're always hanging out and talking, and the bro squad continues on today. Even though we have wives and stuff now. And I'll tell you, when I hang out with my other friends that don't have this little community, that don't have this tribe, they look and they feel and they exude, they feel old, or they don't have the same vitality. They don't have the same kind of like I'm the same colorful, eccentric guy that I was when I was 19 years old. You know, man, my friends that just went and got married and went, and now they just work a job and they come home and they watch TV until they pass out and then get up and go to work again, and then they go on two vacations a year. Those guys, that like, I feel that they're,
that's not living.
They've lost the light in their
eyes.
Yeah,
that's not really a life.
That's a video on repeat. It's not a life.
Yeah, but that's what the average man is today. And you know, I mean, he doesn't have his bro squad. He doesn't have those.
That's kind of what I meant to agree with you when I said that fraternity is the way forward. I think that especially for people like us, this idea of the wolf pack, of the bro squad, like you're saying, we really need that to be healthy going forward, especially in society that's increasingly atomized, that it's increasingly irreligious or anti-religious. And especially, you know, when a lot of our the people who would call themselves our compatriots are people we would not necessarily agree with. It's really important to have like-minded people that you are fraternal with, that like you can say, you know, I would have this guy's back and he would have mine. And you can say that reliably and faithfully. That's a really important thing for men of all ages to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's you know, in a world where things aren't authentic, in a world where things aren't true and people don't really mean things and there's no genuine belief in everything, it's deeply spiritual to have a group of people that would die for you. I could make a phone call with my kinsmen right now and say, guys, we got to go fight. We would go, me and my brothers, we would go and we would fight and we would die together. And we're just a bunch of goofballs. Like, we're not soldiers or nothing, but we would die for each other. And having that real, true, genuine bond is something that modern people don't have, and it sucks the life out of them. So if what we're doing is something akin to the wolf cult, then, you know, everybody should have a wolf cult.
Well, now I'm going to read way more into that than you meant it, but yes, everyone should have a wolf cult. But yeah, you're entirely right. I think in this sense, the emulation of the wolf will be very psychologically healthy for all of us. You know, something that I personally am working on, because as I said, I'm not a theologian, I'm not a great scholar. My worship, my religious beliefs have always been very personal. And when I think about Odin, and when I think about the wolf as kind of a totemic creature or an entity, I think about three, you know, professions or archetypes that come to mind in association both with the wolf and with Odin, and that is, you know, the warrior, the hunter, and the shaman. Now, my friend Andre that, you know, we had before, he told me once that I reminded him of a shaman more than a priest, in the sense that a lot of what I do is more gut instinct and intuition rather than through copious amounts of study and deliberation and whatnot. But I, you know, like all people, I have faults. And the last couple of years, actually, I would say I've almost fallen into a pattern of not irreligiousness, but just kind of being apathetic almost. And so the last couple months or so, having it be rekindled has been very much invigorating for me. And so something I've kind of adopted to try to better myself, and to, you know, be a better student, be a better, more pious person, is that I'm trying to emulate those three archetypes within my own personal life as it applies to Odin and the wolves. And so, you know, this Odinic wolf cult that I'm more or less talking about. And so if you think about, you know, the warriors, the defender of the homestead, the, destruction of one's enemies. And I mean that in a very loose sense. I don't want a Fed post or nothing like that. I mean it in a very loose, vague sense. But, you know, it's a very important part of life.
We could say the destruction of one's enemies in Minecraft.
In Minecraft, definitely. Yeah. Those little monsters with the picks are creepy. So it's really important, especially as society gets more lawless and chaotic, that you have this warrior archetype both within yourself and within your mannerbund, your wolf pack. Because you're going to need it. You're going to need to make a shield wall to, I guess, make a very tropish reference. You're going to need to make a shield wall with your brothers. And that's something I need to work on, because I've neglected friendships with people that I'm close to. I've kind of become reclusive. I used to be in a lot better shape than I am now. I've gotten kind of skinny, which I don't like. So it's, you know, I really need to get back to work physically and fraternally, in a sense, to be better. The hunter, you know, the hunter is the basis of sustenance in human society, going back to, you know, the hunter-gatherers of primordial Ice Age era and before that. And so, you know, for me, learning to hunt, learning to track, being able to survive and sustain myself in the wild, like, you know, a young man living in the wilderness would, like, you know, in the archaic days of the wolf cult, the young men having to cut their teeth as outlaws in the wilderness. I think it's very important to learn those naturalistic skills, understand how they function in the natural order, your place in the natural order, and how to proceed from there. And that's, you know, something that me as a former urbanite and now kind of a boonzenite is something I really need to work on. You know, I love target shooting and I love guns, but I've never even really been hunting seriously. So it's something I aim to really work on to become self-sustaining. And because I have half a dozen wolf dogs, I really look forward to having all the organ meat to feed them and all the elk, bones and hide and whatnot to give them to chew on and save me a lot of money. But finally, and probably most importantly, is the shamanistic aspect, in the sense of Odin being the great seer, the one who sacrificed himself to himself for the knowledge of the cosmos and whatnot. I meditate a lot. I try to do it for 2 hours a day. Sometimes I'm not good and I forget, but I try to meditate. And the thing I do is I always kind of isolate myself and I reflect upon who I, like, you know, my character, my actions, where I am in my life and in society, in the world. And I try to look at it almost from an outside perspective, almost as if I was trying to sit upon the lid scale of myself and view my life from a third person perspective. And it helps me really kind of fix things that I want to focus on and, you know, repair myself as a character, more or less, to get through life. And as I go forward on my spiritual learning and religious study, it's very important to me to kind of keep those lessons of humility and scope in mind. And so what I usually do is I envision myself at the shores of like a pond or a small lake and at about twilight, forest setting usually. And I just kind of let my consciousness go from there. But something that I really wanted to touch on that I feel is really important is whenever I meditate, I always envision having a great spear in my lap, just kind of sitting across my thighs. And to the point where I try to envision, really feel the oak haft in my grip or the cool steel of the head at the end of it. Because Odin's, an image very much associated with him is his spear Grungnir. And, the Ulfhithnar, they're often depicted as having spears in artwork and in whatnot. So the spear is very much a weapon, I would say, that goes with the wolf almost in kind of a symbolistic or aesthetic sense. And it's also, Odin's weapon, and it's also the chief weapon of the hunter. Now, in a lot of cultures, especially the classical ones, the great hunters, and even, Skathi in our own, are depicted as wielding bows and arrows, which makes sense. It's a very useful tool for hunting, probably more so than a spear in most uses.
I've actually argued that point before, that I think, especially in the continental areas where you're getting in heavy forest, it's actually might be more useful to use a heavy spear or a javelin to hunt because of the underbrush and the trees and everything of that sort that could just...
And it depends on what you're hunting.
Boar, you're definitely going to prefer a spear. But actually, kind of as it pertains to that, that too. So if you think about a spear, if you're using it offensively like a hunter, it gives you reach, it gives you range. You can throw it if it's a specific kind that works for that purpose. But, it's very much the symbol of the hunter, the pursuer, the aggressor, very much like that wild wolf, the kind of vaguely evil, but not really, sense that we were talking about earlier. But the spear is also the pinnacle weapon of defense. It's got reach, so if something's advancing on you, you can kind of give it that one final thrust as like a last-ditch effort. And I've read in certain, literature, there are spears that are called things like, a wolf biter or something like that, because, it's supposed to be an allegory both to its nature as the weapon of the hunter and as, the symbolic weapon of Odin. But so I think there's a lot of aesthetic and almost totemic potency and significance to the spear, both for Odin and the wolf, because it's representative of the hunter, the pursuer, the attacker. But also
we got to remember that the spear might be the most primitive or original weapons humanity has ever made.
Besides the club, probably. Yeah, certainly. But it's very much an offensive weapon in some context, and it's very much a defensive weapon in some context, much in the same way you might compare a wolf and a hound.
Yeah.
Well, one is very defensive. That German means spearman. Gatter is the old word for spear.
Yeah.
So we're literally named after the spear. We are the spearmen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, yes, and the spear is kind of like the first tool that is definitely to be used against someone else's life, like whether it's animal or person. It's kind of a knife on a knife on a stick, right? I mean, it's a knife that you can reach with.
Well, it's funny because the comparison I'm drawing, you know, the hound versus the wolf, you know, defense versus offense, is Andre had the theory because, you know, dire wolves went extinct within, you know, geologically speaking, recent memory. And so he wondered if the dire wolves are almost the inspiration for the warg because, you know, they were, to our knowledge, more aggressive, larger, more deadly to primitive man than, you know, the wolves we know, Canis lupus. So is it possible that the direwolf is the inspiration for the warg and that the wolves like Gary and Freck, you know, the ones that are, you know, not so bad or more ambivalent, those are more represented by the wolves we know, since those are the ones we were able to tame and domesticate and bring to our side, much in the way that they sit at the side of Odin at his throne.
So you mean like the Fenrir's wolf would be more of a dire wolf?
Right, and Gary and Freki would just be, you know, wolves that were possibly domesticated in the primordial days. It's a very interesting theory. He just kind of casually suggested
The only real issue I see with that theory is that I'm pretty sure dire wolves came from North America.
Right, I pointed that out, but he made the point that it was the Ice Age, so there could have been some crossings that we don't necessarily know of or account for. But like I said, it's an interesting theory. I wouldn't put too much salt into it.
Yeah, well, how long ago did dire wolves die out?
Oh, around the...
less than 10,000 years
ago. Yeah.
Really?
I mean, I think the Sphinx was around when there were still dire wolves on the planet, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm sorry, Miss Heidi, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just kind of sort of thinking about how wolf and hound, you know, how there is sort of like a sliding scale, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and what you all were just saying about needing your wolf pack as a man, we're kind of getting into the times, I suppose, where we need to slide more towards the wolf characteristics just because it's necessary. And then at different times, it's necessary to slide more towards the hound in order to keep, you know, the inner realm safe.
I would say in an era like, you know, the Dark Ages, the turn of the first millennium or whatever, 1080, around then is when you'd want to definitely gravitate to the hound side of things, because, you know, crops are not stable, society's not stable, life is pretty dangerous and kind of crappy. Days like today, you're absolutely right. You know, things are too sedentary. They're too soft. They're too weak. We need a little bit. And that's why, I mean, I hate to come across as maybe a little hostile or unhinged or something, but I think we need a little bit of Fang in our lives, a little bit of Jack London in our daily literature choice.
Well, I'll be a bit more unhinged here and say that violence is often much better than people think it is, and everyone needs more violence in their life.
It's honest, dude. Like, you know, the one thing I will say to, like, you know, the hoodlums of the world, or maybe not hoodlums, but, you know, the violent, you know, street brawlers of the world, is at least those people air their grievances with each other honestly, albeit savagely, versus the norm of society where, you know, in suburbia, all these neighbors smile and wave at each other while muttering under their breath how much they despise one another.
Well, and I mean, violence is always the final, like the highest level, basically, that without a threat of violence, you can't have nonviolent conflict.
Voting
either.
Is violence, if you think about it. I mean,
it absolutely is.
When you vote, you're enforcing your will on someone else.
I mean,
voting
is basically just two armies lining up together and seeing which one is bigger,
In the context of the episode, democracy and voting is two wolves voting on eating the sheep for dinner.
Now, you mentioned something. There's a, I can't remember which story it was, but there's a really awesome quote from one of the Conan books where Conan says something along the lines of, yeah, I may be a barbarian and we settle our disputes with blood and steel, but I don't trust urban people and civilized people because they're sly. And I can't remember what it was.
But yeah, I was actually going to quote that a second ago, Dave. I think what you're thinking of is... The more I see of what you call civilization, the more highly I regard that which you call savagery.
That's it. So bad. But, you know, speaking of like, don't even worry about sounding like, I very much push the meme of hashtag get mafia pilled, because we live in a machine that is hostile to us. We live in a machine that drains us of our resources. We live in a machine that is entirely vampiric and parasitic to us. So I suggest that it's time that we tribe up and we rob the machine and plunder it for the good of our tribes, to enrich our tribes. And I wanted to bring something up. It was like you mentioned about how the mentality of urbanite versus ruralite. And this is something that I very much noticed right away. I grew up in kind of a rural setting. I wasn't like out in,
not like Egypt. Me rural, but
yeah, not like in the middle of nowhere. But I grew up in a very rural farmland setting where people had chickens, people had farm animals, people had burn barrels. The trash didn't pick it up. You had to go to the post office because the mailman didn't go out that far. So I grew up in a setting like that. So it's when I moved into a more urbanite setting, I noticed right away there was a change in my mentality, in my worldview, and everything like changed with it. Because when you are a ruralite, you don't have rules. Yeah, I mean, you have the law of I don't want to say the law of nature, because too many people conflate that but it doesn't matter. You are pretty much at the mercy of nature. You can freeze to death. You can get attacked by a bear. Your chickens can get eaten by a fox. You know what I mean? Like, stuff can happen. You know what I mean?
No one will ever know.
And sometimes no one will ever know. If you go out into the woods and you fall and you break your leg, that might be your grave. However, when you move into an urbanite setting, it changes your mentality, and then from that,
people put it on World Star. Everyone knows about it.
It's like, well, it's like you can't pop if you live in, say, like suburban New Jersey, and you walk outside and slip and break your leg, you're going to be at the hospital. Somebody's going to hear it. They're going to call an ambulance. There's safety nets everywhere. You have to be dumb to die. You know what I mean? Like, you really have to do, you have to like try on purpose to die in urbanite New Jersey. But what I'm getting at here is, because of this vast urbanization, and even places, I go to places now that were like 20 years ago where there were people that didn't have social security numbers and you had to pay for cash everywhere. It's like everything has, everything is completely urbanized. Everything is completely, swamped with technology, and it's completely different. So this mentality of urbanization is going out to all of society now. And what I wanted to point out was, even in my recent family history, there were guys that would just like load up and go out and get into gunfights with other guys just because they hated them or because they had a monetary dispute. You had guys like, in the early 1900s here in PA, you had to be careful traveling to town because there were guys that would hang out in the woods and rob people. Guys were doing gangster stuff. We don't see that anymore. As far as our folk, like our folk have been so deeply urbanized that everybody's scared to break the law. Everybody is scared of being an outlaw. Everybody is scared of not following the rules. The rules are the most important thing, even if you hate them and you complain about them. So when you get this urbanized mindset, you get further away from the sliding scale of the wolf, and you are forced to become the hound. You know what I mean?
Even still a hound, to be honest. I mean, maybe you're just a chihuahua at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. You're not a mastiff. You're a Yippie Taco Bell dog.
Yeah. So,
I mean, what you're talking about, I mean, where I live, we don't have woods hobos, but, I live fairly close to the border. I mean, you have people like literal cartel agents that are walking around with like backpacks full of cocaine, and if they see you, like if you're a hiker or something, they'll just straight up kill you because you're a potential witness.
Yeah, I mean, I live right on a major drug corridor, and they don't really do anything in town because they fear the federal government coming down on them like a ton of bricks. But it's very obvious that they come through here, and everyone knows who they are. Or
Yep. Also,
they don't mess with you if you're not in the game, so to speak. But
yeah.
The second you are, you better you're pretty fucked if you do something wrong.
They got a long reach too. It's pretty scary, honestly.
Yeah.
But
the point I was getting at is there's no more that sense of like there's no inner gangster anymore in people. My grandparents' generation, there were guys who were like, yeah, well, I don't really care about the laws. I'm trying to make some money. Or I don't really care about the laws. I'm trying to do this. They would act on the outside of the law just because. Now people fear it. You know what I mean? Like, people are scared to make a wrong
Facebook
post.
There's a real big societal shift that's went on in the last couple of decades, I think, where people have – the average man is much more likely to call the cops on someone and expect the cops to do something about it. Whereas, you know, even like my grandfather lived in a time in which – if you got into a fist fight with another man, that was just the end of it. You both went home and, you know.
Well, I mean, there's less social cohesion, right? I mean, there people are less, feel less related or less, I don't know, tribal with each other. And they're not as comfortable solving their own issues amongst themselves. And it's sort of like it's a vicious cycle because they, you know, if the other person thinks that that someone else might call the cops, they want to be the first to call the cops, and so it just kind of perpetuates itself in a way.
It plays into the victim culture mentality it's like, I need to tattle first.
It's like being validated.
That's a very valid issue, though. It's prevention. You know, the first person who calls the cops is the one that gets recorded as the guy who's right.
Yeah, so that perpetuates this sort of like behavior.
It's like people have.
And then
more
that
allegiance.
Only happens because people don't trust each other anymore to do the normal thing. They expect to do the worst thing.
Is it that they don't trust each other, or is it just that they have more allegiance to the machine than they do their own tribe?
I think that's
a bit
same
of both.
Thing.
If you want to talk about why that's going on, I think it's mostly to do with what, as I've mentioned, the feminization of society. The idea that you're going to go to like the great granddaddy in the sky and he's going to make everyone do the rule is a very stereotypically feminine trait of social interaction that men just don't really follow and haven't historically followed.
It's funny that they want to destroy the patriarchy, but their very psychology revolves around the patriarchy because they have to go to the male authority figure to arbitrate their dispute.
And again, violence is at the top tier of solving these issues.
Yep. Well, I mean, of course, the police are just men who are coming to do violence to you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why whenever you see those trucks that have two bumper stickers, one says Molon Labe, the other says Thin Blue Line, you can't help but roll your eyes. Like,
yeah.
Oh, those
you
are the
think
worst
those
people
coming into.
Yeah, that's it doesn't make sense to me because I'm very Ian, you mentioned earlier about how you're not really like of an orthodox mind. You're of somebody that's very into praxis, where you're more into the intuitive. I argue that everybody should do both. You should be able to roll out your apologetics and understand the theology and stuff like that. And then you should also be able to go into the woods with your boys, eat some shrooms, and wild out. That's like, to me, spirituality must be both. You must have the wild side, and you must also have the refined philosophical side in together in order to have like to achieve the. And that's exactly what Odin is all about. Odin is.
I was about to say, I think that's very wise of you because that's the example that's put forth for us in Odin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to say. He you know, as you said, he sacrificed himself with this great discipline and fasting and like, you know, went through this very hard, horrible, ascetic 9 days to learn this great wisdom. And he's the sky father and he's very wise and he knows how society, how the cosmos is ordered. But then also he drinks mead and wiles out and goes into these crazed, you know, he's both. And he drinks of the mead of inspiration. You know what I mean? The mead of inspiration is like a crazed state where you get all this like metaphysical information.
Odin imbibes the mead of poetry, but he also imparts the fear of Teutonicus.
Exactly.
Oh, you know that I forgot to mention that the whole genetic component to the battle trance. I mean, even I think it was Livy or maybe some other Roman that talked about how the Germans just had this cultural quality of losing their minds in battle and becoming merciless savages, which is, you know, pretty metal. But I was going to say, you know, like you're talking about how you think both, you know, the scholar and the wild element is a good balance to strike. One reason why I'm so glad to have, you know, kind of stumbled upon you guys and like the Sidian Society and all that sort of thing is because I've been looking for a while for a way to study better and to really hammer home the idea of making it not official, but, you know, really understanding the theology of it and being able to argue it in the same way that, you know, scholars out of a Christian university would, their own faith.
Yeah,
I think that's really important, and it really beneficial to me as a person. So I'm grateful.
You know, I've actually just I just thought of something here, and I pulled it up real quick, and I'd like to read it. It's from the De Bello Gallico, the Gallic Wars, written by Julius Caesar, when he's talking about when he first encounters the Germans.
Yeah, that's
and it's recorded money, right? Here. Yeah, and it's it says here in chapter 39. While here he is tarrying a few days at Bisontio on account of corn and provisions, from the inquiries of our men and the reports of the Gauls and traders, who asserted that the Germans were men of huge stature, of incredible valor and practice in arms, that oftentimes they, on encountering them, could not even bear their countenance and the fierceness of their eyes. So great a panic on a sudden seized the whole army as to discompose the minds and spirits of all in no slight degree.
Can you imagine being a Roman soldier at Teutoburg Forest? You're in the woods at night. You have no idea what's
going on. And, you know, the Romans, we talked about this a little in the Roman episode. The Romans were terrified of the forest.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they regarded it as the place where, you know, the wild things were. And so you're a Roman soldier in the woods in the dark. You have no idea what's going on. Your whole force is disorganized. And all of a sudden you start hearing like howling and shrieking and all sorts of devilish noises. And then all of a sudden all these giant naked dudes painted black and screaming out of the woods, chopping heads off. It's like, what the hell? Like, I don't blame them for thinking the Hari ghost warriors were like literal evil spirits. Because, I mean, if you were a Roman, had never been to that part of the world, never encountered these people, That's a very striking image, and I don't blame them for having that connotation.
And
it's pretty impressive.
Romans were very much a wealthy, decadent, urban society. And the overwhelming majority of legitimate battles between the Germans and the Romans won just because they had better technology, they had tactics. The Roman army was the
best. If the Romans could bring up with a shield formation and get their battle tactics going, they would win, but anytime they were ambushed or they had to like break up their formation and fight one on one with the German, they'd get slaughtered. Yeah,
and that is because number one,
you know,
they were probably the Germans rained terror upon the Romans because these Romans, they were urbanites. They had money. They had property to go back to. They didn't want to just die. They were professional soldiers. Whereas the Germans were just like, they're like, please send me to the next life. You know what I mean? They were just drunk with battle rage, and they just wanted to fight and kill and die, and they didn't care. And that's like something.
So the Romans,
you know, that's part of the reason Julius Caesar took up the Germans as his own personal body.
The
Byzantines made it with the Vikings and everything, and it was because the Germanic people were renowned even in the ancient world for being these guys who, no matter what, would literally just stand there and fight and die.
Yeah, they
and
were
everyone
loyal
else would
to,
run away.
Loyal to a fault almost. I mean, the Batavian Guard and, you know, that ended up becoming the Germanic Guard. The reason that the Roman emperors preferred those to the Praetorians is, you know, the Praetorians, much like the later Janissaries, ended up becoming a political machine. But the Germans, you know, you paid them, you fed them, you kept their bellies full of wine and, you know, food and all of, you know, they will fight to the end for you. The Varangians that he brought up, I mean, they did the same thing. They're recorded in numerous battles, you know, fighting on, you know, even though they're pagan Norsemen, they're fighting on behalf of the Christian Byzantines, and they fight to literally the last man to hold the fort or hold the line because that's
there's
their
actually
order.
An interesting historical occurrence in which after the assassination of the Emperor Nero, his German bodyguard freaked the fuck out and basically seized control of Rome for weeks and went around punishing all of the noble aristocrats that they decided were at fault in the assassination until they decided that justice had been meted out, and then they gave back control of the state.
Well, there was an incident too where there was an emperor in Byzantium that was assassinated, and the Varangians murdered the assassin and his conspirators. And then they just took all the emperor's possessions and shit. And then the other people were like, hey, what are you doing? They're like, oh, well, the emperor's dead. Like, you know, we avenged him. This is our payment. And, you know, really interesting about the Varangian Guard, real quick, is that they are recorded in Byzantine sources as having done a Gothic dance. That's what the Greeks called it. And that was
around a fireplace.
Right. And it brought on their battle fear, their battle trance. So there's very much a link between the practices of the old, you know, wolf cults going from the Roman era to the Viking Age all the way into the early medieval period, as far away as the Eastern Mediterranean. It's really wonderful how encompassing our ancestors and their wolf might was. I take pride in that.
And how pan-Germanic it was. It was something that, it wasn't something that was just, you know, I argue with the regionalist type minded people a lot. They think they're the type of people that think that, you know, Odin and Woden and Votan are different gods, and, you know, every specific is completely different. And when you actually study it, it's like, man, there were runestones, there were runestones in Sweden hailing Germanic kings in Italy, like Lombard kings. Like, this was, they were like a cohesive, like folk. Yeah, there was some linguistic and regional expressions, but as a whole, there were traditions that they did in the continental region that went all the way up to Scandinavia. That was just all over the place. It was like, it was, they were
there's actually a Germanic word for someone who's not Germanic. It was Valha.
The word Welsh comes from Valha. Yeah.
Yeah. Miss Heidi, you were going to say something a few minutes ago. What were you about to say?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I was just kind of like stuck on that idea of the wolf, the hound wolf scale. I was just kind of thinking about how that might be applied to the Romans and the Germans. You know,
hey, Tristan, does that remind you of the comparison we made about Lehman Russ?
That does quite a bit, actually. I mean, we should, make an effort to do a full analysis on that one, because it is rather interesting.
We'll do it at some point.
And that's pretty interesting, considering what is the creation myth of Rome with the
Romulus and Remus suckling from the she wolf. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Capitoline Wolf was sent by Mars to basically nurse them after their uncle tried to usurp them and whatnot.
Yeah, that's incredible. All right, folks, we are 15 minutes over, but is there anything else in closing we would like to talk about with the wolf cult?
No, I just...
I think we covered pretty much everything we went through.
Yeah, I got to talk about most of my favorite topics. I'm glad that it was given the opportunity to go into these sorts of things. Miss Heidi, thank you for being here and conversing with us about canons and whatnot.
No, thank you, too.
Wonderful. All right, folks, we're going to shut it down for this evening, but thank you to Heidi, thank you to Ian, thank you to Tristan for coming on and talking about the wolf cult. What a fascinating conversation. Covered a lot of really cool things.
Join it.
A lot of really
join
great,
the wolf cult.
Join the wolf. Start a wolf cult. Start one. Yeah. So let's
get, I actually want to
not, get not the kind of wolf cult that has like oiled up wrestlers in the back. Do not join any of those.
Go the whole episode without bringing them up. Yeah. Tristan,
no. We'll slide them in right at the end. No.
Why do you gotta use that precise word?
Why, yeah. Ooh. Get oiled up, slide. Come on, bub. Jesus. All right, so yeah, we're not gonna talk about that. So that's going to be the end of the episode. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Make sure to go to facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish and check out some Vedic astrology. Make sure you give them a shout and tell them Big Dave sent you. This stuff is incredible. I'm telling you. I've always been skeptical of horoscopes, because everything that we do in the West with it is pretty weird and goofy and kind of a bastardization, but they really encapsulated it in ancient Vedic society, and Iron Age Jyotish is an expert with ancient Vedic astrology. He gave me a full reading. It was incredible. So go over to Iron Age Jyotish, facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish, and check him out. Get yourself a reading. Tell him Big Dave sent you. And also, make sure to go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. If you like what we do here on The Bog, you want to support us, there's a tier there for everybody. You can get your RSS feed. You can there's a whole bunch of stuff on there. So make sure you check it out. We got t-shirts coming out real soon. We're going to have some merchandise. Also, I got mushroom tea. The Bog is going to be selling mushroom tea that I make in-house. So that's going to be really cool when that's coming out. But anyway, guys, make sure you
and
like
it. Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Will it make you go berserk?
No, this is completely.
It's not that kind of mushroom.
No. Okay. Not kind of, I don't think we could sell this kind of mushrooms on TV. Yeah.
It would be cool, like, but you know, I don't think they'd let us do it.
I know we were talking about operating outside of the law and stuff with our wolf packs, but I'm pretty sure just out doing that, selling magic mushrooms on a podcast will probably get us in a little bit of trouble. So we're definitely not going to do that. But so anyway, mushroom tea is coming very soon, but everybody make sure you like, subscribe, share over on the YouTube channel, which I upload all of our episodes, so you can check it out later on reviews. You can also replay it here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell, where the Bog is live every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. Make sure to check out Nerona.org and Ariakasha.com, as well as t.me/primordialpath. So anyway, guys, thank you so much.
And check out the Patreon now. We have that up on.
Yes, sir. Patreon.com/TheBog. And I'll see you guys next time, next Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. Hail you guys. Hail the folk. Hail the gods. Hail victory. I'll see you next time. Hail.